And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
With just 26 letters, all the wisdom in the English language has been penned. And with just 7 notes and 5 half notes, all of the world's music has been written. And with just 3 primary colors, all of the colors on earth can be mixed. Taken together, these 39 elementaries have driven the creation of the finest expressions of the master mammals on planet Earth. We look at this and more as we go in depth with the visionary art of Jen Troot when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As we count down to next year's election, or perhaps even more amazing, the primaries in less than 2 months, the 17 or so presidential candidates are trying to paint a clear picture of who they are and where they stand on the issues. All of the political commentators are looking for the unique characteristics of the candidates that help them stand out. Show us who they are. Well, here's my observations. If you look at just the last names of the candidates, the most common letters are the N, with a total of 11, then E with 10, and A with 9. The candidates with the most frequency of the top 3 letters are Giuliani, Huckabee, and Tancredo, tied with 3 each. All of the candidates, except one, contain one or more of the top 3 letters. If you're looking for the unique candidate, it's Dodd, with 3 D's and an O. No top letters in his name. And the letters J, Q, X, and Z are not represented by any candidate. You'll have to draw your own conclusions. In the next year, each of us will be subjected to millions of words by these candidates, and still, we may not see clearly who they are. We may need a better way of interpreting these complex issues. The same is true in our current challenge to understand the complex issues facing us about our environment. With so much information coming at us, it can become difficult to make our way through the counterbalancing forces at work on this, our little Earth. But we may be overlooking one of the most powerful human creations for understanding the complexities and depths of meaning. Art. And that's where we're going with today's show, as we go in depth with artist Jen Troot, whose powerful work surveys the current state of the art of our floundering arc. Artists use their vision to help us see. We'll be talking with Jen during both segments 1 and 2, following this week's abbreviated Weekly Earth Summit and News. So now, the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Today, we have a briefing from two of our regular guests. We begin with Dr. Charles Kennell, who is launching the new Sustainability Institute at the University of California, San Diego, following his role as director of the prestigious Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Dr. Kennell provides his panoramic vision of the pathways that need to be forged by new generations of change agents. Dr. Kennell?
I would call this second generation solutions. The first generation of solutions have been thought up and have been in the advocacy literature for about 20 years. And they are simple things that are now beginning to happen. For a long time now, people are advocating going to hybrid cars. Well, now some people are building them. and some people are making them attractive to consumers. Something that you hear on the radio all the time now here in Southern California is that global warming is not only a fact, but it's an opportunity. And you need now to think about things like replacing your incandescent bulbs with fluorescent bulbs, which use about a fifth the energy. And so there are some simple things that we can do, that we all know how to do, that we should do. Change our lighting, insulate our houses, buy a more modern refrigerator. All of these things will help. But at the end of the day, those are just the first steps. We need to do them, but we're going to find after 10 years when we've done them that we've still got a problem. And so, and it's in the 10-year horizon that the scientists and the engineers have to think, or the 20-year horizon, because we really need to transform the way we do much of our commerce and our business and our engineering. And so now, in this particular area, the engineers are saying, well, what we need to engineer is a worldwide information network that will give us continuous awareness of the state of our environment so that we'll always know what's going on and we'll make fewer mistakes in our decisions. But it's got to be a global thing. It's got to be a Google for the environment with all sorts of key information that's easy for people to understand, reliable, up-to-date, and addresses their problems. Not just the problems that scientists want to see addressed, which are very important and will always provide the basis, but also the problems that people have. And so that gets you into a totally different kind of information network that uses spacecraft and sensor nets and stream gauges and measures the snow and the snowpack and the green color of the ocean to know where all the chlorophyll-bearing plants are. That we all know how to do, but now it's time to tie it all together, make it useful to people, and the system engineers are going to play a role in that.
Thank you, Dr. Cannell. And next we hear from one of those emerging change agents, Ben Lowe, who is working with Aroca.org while serving his community in the Chicago area. Ben?
It's not easy being green. Kermit the Frog is famous for that song, and many people continue to use it as a pretense for not living sustainably. Often, it is a shameful excuse that reflects our laziness and apathy more than anything. But there may also be some truth to this statement. Going green can often be complicated and sometimes challenging. I recently moved to a neighborhood in inner city Chicago with some friends. We've made a lot of changes in our apartment, such as switching all the light bulbs out to compact fluorescents and hang drying clothes on the line. But when we wanted to recycle, we just couldn't figure out how. Apparently, the city has an extensive blue bag recycling program that gets proudly promoted everywhere. Even so, our landlord and neighbors did not know how the system worked. We finally looked it up online and found a list of stores where we could pick up the blue recycling bags at. The next problem? That none of the stores on that list in our area actually carries the blue bags or even knows where to get them. After a few frustrating weeks of searching, we now stockpile our recycling by the back door and take it all into the suburbs to throw away when we happen to be out there. I suspect that most of our neighborhood does not actually go to such lengths to recycle, however. Whether it is trying to recycle, choosing between paper, plastic, and styrofoam, or sorting through the myriad of other confusing programs, advice, and options, there are many ways we can still help make it easier and more accessible for our communities to go green. We need to take the good science we know and apply it more effectively through awareness, education, and implementation. But let's not overlook the details, too. For one, I happen to know a neighborhood in Chicago that really needs blue recycling bags.
Thanks, Ben. Join us each week as we bring you the leading voices for a better world on the Weekly Earth Summit. And now, a brief news update. Then we go in-depth with artist Jen Troot. So now, the news. As the environment and global warming continues to evade any real discussion by the presidential hopefuls, this week, Hillary Clinton made news as she attempted to introduce the subject into one of her news conferences. You have to give her credit for at least trying to talk about the issue. Unfortunately, the story leaked out that the question was asked by a young woman at the request of a Clinton campaign staff manager. Since then, this gaffe is regaled as evidence that she's no better than anyone else. Unfortunately, the media has focused on this aspect of the story and as yet have not covered at all what she actually said about addressing global warming. Time for a reality check. Oil spills are mucking up the oceans and beaches in San Francisco and Russia this week. 58,000 gallons of heavy fuel oil were released into San Francisco Bay following the collision of a massive container ship with a pier supporting the Bay Bridge. Rescue workers and 1,000 volunteers are working around the clock to save as many of the 1,000 or more birds and sea mammals slobbered by the toxic fuel oil. Estimates are that it will take weeks to stabilize the situation. At the same time, rescuers recovered the bodies of 3 sailors after a Russian freighter sank near the Black Sea, resulting in a slick of oil washing onto the beaches throughout the area. 30,000 birds have died, and fears are that the damage to fish may be devastating. As many as 10 ships sank or ran aground in the northern Black Sea region during a fierce storm that lashed the waters with 18-foot waves. Russian authorities are predicting that it will take years to fix the damage. It is considered a very serious environmental disaster. And finally, from Valencia, Spain, the UN's top climate official challenged world policymakers Monday to map out a path to curb climate change, charging that to ignore the urgency of climate warming would be nothing less than criminally irresponsible. Ivo de Boer issued his warning at the opening of a week-long conference that will complete a concise guide on the state of global warming and what can be done to stop the Earth from overheating. It is the fourth and last report issued this year by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, co-winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Environmentalists and authors of the report expected tense discussions on what should be included and what is being left out of the document, which is a synthesis of thousands of scientific papers. The final report is expected to be completed on Saturday. We will be bringing you reports on the findings during next week's show. And that's the news. And a reminder, got a news tip? Send it to your Voice of the Earth here at wildsidenews.com. And now to our special in-depth look into the life and passions of visionary Earth artist Jen Troot. There's so many ways that people are getting involved in trying to help this Earth survive and perhaps heal and find a way for us to relate to it in a way that makes sense again, and it comes in all forms. Change requires all sorts of players to succeed. We have lots of people who are out getting involved in politics. There's people doing music. Al Gore is out there doing films. And as well, there's many people doing various forms of art that talks and communicates and informs us about the Earth and our relationship to it. Some people might call this nature art. Some people might call it environmental art. The other day, I was lucky to go to a local art gallery here outside of San Diego, to the Cannon Gallery, which is north of San Diego a bit in Carlsbad. They do have typically very fine work there. And I entered expecting to see something nice. But I was struck by one of the artist's work who is in San Diego. Her name is Jen Troot, and she's going to join us now to talk about her work. Jen, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Your work is very different than many artists that are involved in sort of earth things, things related to helping us to understand our relationship to the earth. And I'll just give you my impression. The images were, in many cases, startling. They're strong iconographic pieces. Skeletal figures, for example, in green,
and many, many other forms, many beautifully rendered animals as well, just really wonderful foxes and birds, as well as various forms of landscape, including some natural, but then as well many images of the human landscape. You don't just assemble them in simple storylines. Your work is very, very complex in terms of its story. And so throughout the conversation today, I'd like to explore that. And we'll talk about the work. As an artist, why don't you define sort of how you came to be an artist?
Well, I was always working as an artist. I went to art school in Boston, worked as a graphic designer and illustrator. I did storyboards for quite a few years, actually, worked in a lot of large ad agencies. About 10 years ago, I started really focusing on doing my own painting, and I've been doing this environmental painting since then. I did a little bit of portraiture part-time while I was doing the illustration work earlier. But since about 1998, I've been doing the environmental work exclusively, mainly because I've, you know, like so many other people, I've just been so bothered about what's happening. And I finally got to the point in my life where I had to do whatever I could in my, you know, using my talents about it. So I use my skills as a person who worked with advertising for a long time to tell stories in as intense and provocative a way as I can, using a single image, like an ad you would see in a magazine. For a little while, I thought I wanted to do children's books and tell stories about the environment using 30 illustrations at a time. I was used to doing a lot of illustrations to tell a story when I did storyboard work. And then I realized what I really want to do is tell a story in one image. I just love to spend as much time as I possibly can fleshing out one single image and using that one visual to tell the whole story. So that's what I do. I spend a lot of time on each piece.
It's obvious to me that your work in illustration, it serves you well in terms of your mission. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about your work, is the fact that it's exciting work to look at. It's interesting work to look at. You use, for example, Barbie doll images, and we'll talk about why. But they're rendered so beautifully, so wonderfully. When you're looking at the images, there's many places for the mind to go to recognize things that are familiar to us, and both in a very friendly way, but also oftentimes in looking at your work, the more you look, the more you realize there's many more layers to the story. So the one thing that I would say, and I encourage people to go to the website, you can see a lot of Jen Truitt's work on today's show page. In terms of having people find more of your work, why don't we just share your website at this point?
Mm-hmm. It's jentrute.com, JENTRUTE.com.
Yeah, that would be a great way to really see what we're talking about here. But even before we get into that, now I want to talk about going back into your own life and a personal life, kind of take the art out of it and talk about you and your relationship to nature. It seems obvious to me that you have spent time really looking at nature. You look at the earth. Your interpretations of animals, I would have to believe that you have a real experience with some of these creatures. I don't know if you've been an outdoor person much of your life, if you've done much hiking, or as a child perhaps you spent time in rural areas or in the country or somehow in touch with nature, but I'm just curious about the deep roots. Is there a deep root to this?
Well, when I was a kid, we grew up in an area that was not all that developed. We were in western Massachusetts, and there was a lot of empty land around us. And my happiest childhood memories all have to do with being out in the woods. A lot of times just by myself, letting the imagination go wild, making forts, just living, you know, some sort of fantasy life in the woods. I really feel sorry for kids today who don't have that access, because gosh, your imagination can really, really run wild if you have that sort of freedom as a kid. And we were all like that. All the kids in the neighborhood were like that. It wasn't anything special. So that's how I grew up. That was sort of buried for a long time. I lived in big cities most of my adult life. And then, you know, it all came back when I just got to the point where I felt it's time for me to act.
This environmental focus has really taken on a true passion in your life for a variety of reasons, which we'll talk about. And why don't you give us an entree to that? Because it does really make a difference in terms of helping people understand. And it's until I talked with you about this, it was interesting work, but now it becomes even more interesting.
What happened to me was I got a wake-up call as an artist, as someone who always wanted to do something about problems out there that bothered me but put it off. I got a cosmic crack to the side of the head. I was diagnosed with cancer in 2000, and I had been working as an illustrator for many years. I wanted to do something with my art regarding the environment, but I was just never quite able to get it done. I was so distracted with everything else I was doing, and at one point I even started doing these paintings in I guess it was 96. And they weren't coming along too well because I was new at it, of course. My house needed to be remodeled. I looked at the painting, looked at the house, and said to myself, who am I kidding? I've got to do something about this mess. I put the painting away. It sat under a sheet for a year while we remodeled. And that was that. So I just kept getting distracted. Well, I got the cancer, and I felt that this was my cue. It was my time to, you know, walk up on stage and do my bit. It was a pretty serious case. They found a mass of tumors the size of a pack of cigarettes. I had 3 recurrences after the initial bout with cancer. I had 8 operations, and it was really intense. But what happened at the outset of all of this was I just really came back to the thought that all I really cared about was, well, to put it bluntly, I realized that if I was going to die from this cancer, I wanted to die out in the woods. That's all that mattered to me. It was the only thing that made sense. Somehow going out by myself out to the mountains or someplace, and just being there alone, looking at the leaves falling and the whatever, was the only way that my whole life would make sense to me, and somehow dying would also make sense. I could handle the idea of dying out there. Just, it's like it brought me back to a certain level of reality that I wasn't living in for a long, long, long time. And that was a shocker to me because I felt like I should want to die around my family and friends or go to a hospice or something like that. And, you know, I just came back to the feeling that that I could handle it somehow if I was out in the woods, you know, alone. So, and as I was sick, I got very introverted. I had trouble in social situations. I felt I had my foot was already in the other, one foot was already in the other world. It's almost like I wasn't really quite here anymore. But I developed a greater connection with animals, plants, young children, very young children. It's almost like that level of consciousness or that level of being is what made sense to me when things got to such an intense state. So I was very, very, very strongly reminded of this reality, and it just brought the whole environmental situation into very, very, very sharp focus. I was committed to doing these environmental paintings at that point because I felt there was a need for this kind of work. I really didn't see anybody else out there doing this sort of imagery, you know, two-dimensional painting I thought, okay, I'm going to do it. So I was pretty into these paintings. They were very, very important to me. They represented everything to me. You know, that's why a lot of them are so intense. I don't pussyfoot around the issue of environmental destruction. Some of the paintings are very much in your face, and they're not what you typically think of when you do think of New Age imagery that sort of does have to do with the environment, like you know, beautiful nature photography, or the images of goddesses and marine life, and there's a lot of very nice, gentle imagery out there. And my work is not like that, because I was at that time trying to convey some ideas that are very disturbing, but I think important for us to face, because I think the sooner we can really face these issues, the sooner we're going to make real change.
You know, I can completely understand what you're saying. Number one, I'm a cancer survivor myself. I'm not going to discuss that, but that dramatically changed my life when I was faced with the prospect that perhaps I really wasn't going to live at all. And that does change one's life, and one can determine that it's time to carry out a mission, that life is not to be taken for granted. The time is perhaps our greatest resource, and it couldn't be very limited. And it also opens one's eyes to meaning, searching for deeper meaning, searching for deeper truth. And I think it sounds as if that's what you were at that point confronted. Facing death, as you have, can force one, if one is sensitive, to really get down to basics. And in many respects, that's what you've done. I know that in my work, what I do in terms of nature and environmental radio, and I always make the distinction, nature and the environment, because the two I find separate. They're related, but they're separate. The environment, you do a lot of environmental work, and we'll talk about that. Some of the issues that relate to the toxicity of our world, the way in which that's affecting life and humans and animals, literally that level of toxicity is exhibited in a most intriguing way in your work. At the same time, you celebrate nature, the beauty of the fox, the various creatures that you find in a natural environment, and you do them very wonderfully. That's nature and the environment. And I think we share that similar sort of need to distinguish between the two. And in my work, I know I'm always conflicted with the challenge to try to make sure that I celebrate the beauty and the wonder, but at the same time pose a level of warning that's significant enough for people to realize that this could all be much different 20, 30, 40 years from now. And as you say, going back to your childhood and the significance of that connection at that deep level with the wonder, with the beauty and magic mystery of almost every living thing, I think we probably share the knowledge that those things may not be around for other people to experience.
You know, the thought of that when I was sick was just devastating to me.
Can you reach in and find out why it was devastating to you?
Because I could relate to it. I felt vulnerable. I felt like I was sick, just like it's almost like I could feel the pain of what some of these creatures are going through. It's almost like I couldn't really relate to it until I was deathly ill.
Suddenly I'm understanding something new about your work.
Yeah.
And that is that, to some extent, perhaps even your cancer, you may feel that it was caused by various environmental factors, toxicity in the environment.
I did have a very serious exposure to toxic chemicals. When I was in my early 30s, I worked at an art studio, and we all used markers that had aromatic hydrocarbon liquid in them that we used to spray through airbrush nozzles, so it would all be in the air, and we would blow our noses, and, you know, blue would come out, and there were 10 of us in a small room, And I developed food allergies and chemical sensitivities within 8 months of working in the studio. And then I continued to work with the markers for another 8 years or so, but I didn't have to use them as often. I definitely had a connection, yeah, early on.
It's interesting, as an artist, I had to confront the fact that some of the stuff that I was working with was radically toxic. Many of the cadmium, for example, in paints, there's many very toxic substances that artists work with regularly. And as you say, they're spraying it and they get it on their hands and things of that nature. And I, of course, always felt that I was invincible and these things would never affect me. But just reaching out there to anyone who's involved in the arts, beware. Be careful, you know, because there was a chemical that I was using to speed up the painting of, in oils that I won't mention the brand name, but I didn't typically use that. But I knew that when I used that in my studio, it smelled terribly. And I eventually got sick where I had this lung thing that just wouldn't go away, and I'm otherwise very healthy, and it scared me because it went on for month after month after month where I just, there's something wrong. And it was obviously from that substance, and I finally said I will never, ever use that again because obviously that was radically affecting me. So that's interesting because I hadn't made that correlation, seeing the fact that so many of your figures, for example, one of the startling pieces, yeah, there's many startling pieces in, for example, the Canon show, but the one that I think most people were drawn to, would be drawn to, will be drawn to, is All for Baby. Mm. It's a large piece. Many of your pieces are fairly large, being 4 by 5 feet or 3 by 5 or somewhere in that scale. So they're relatively monumental work. That's fairly large work for a painter, particularly with this level of detail. All for Baby is, why don't you talk about All for Baby? And I encourage people to look at the image on the website. It's very significant.
Well, All for Baby is a domestic scene from a version of the future that I hope we avoid. There's a figure that looks like a mother, and it looks like a little bit like a Barbie doll. It's wearing very elegant clothes, and it has some jewels, and it's got its hand on a mobile as if it's moving the mobile for a little baby that's on a little bed in front of the mother. And the baby has an arm outstretched to the mobile, and there's a little satin headboard with a little crown embossed in it, and the little mobile figures are very pretty. They have jewel-like little shiny pieces on them, and they sort of sparkle in the sunlight. And they're in some sort of a home that's up high above the outside scene, and there are these huge open windows behind the two figures, so you look beyond the two figures and see what's behind them, and you can tell they're way up high, and down below is a huge expanse of some sort of a city. Now, what's a little funky about this scene is that the animals on the mobile are mutated. They have three eyes or one eye or five legs, but they all look happy, you know, like little normal animals. And the scene out the window is of a brown cityscape. It's very dark. There are these huge billowing brown clouds that look like they're coming over the city very ominously, and it looks very, very polluted, and the city looks like a huge slum almost. Off in the distance, there's a tower that says, going up the tower, it says Univew, like a big corporate tower, and at the top, there's a winged shape, like Univew has a winged logo. Now, when you look at the mom's head, she has these big winged things coming out of the side of her head that look an awful lot like the logo on the tower. And when you look at the baby's head, The baby has two little buds at the top of her head, and they're actually, you know, going to grow into these winged things when she gets older. There are two cats in the room. They're, you know, they're the domestic animals, and they're not mutated, but they're a little off, too. They don't have any hair, and one looks very intently at the baby as she reaches up to the mobile. And the other one is a little kitten lying on the bed, and he looks funky, too. Now, there are these little towers also in the background that have lit eyes. So it looks like there are these things out there that are looking over the city. The mobile has a little thing at the top that has these two little lights in it that look kind of like eyes, and they're looking down at the baby. The kitten on the bed is playing with a little bug that has wings that are the same shape as the Barbie's ears and the Uniview tower. So this bug looks like he might be part of whatever's going on too, and he has two little eyes. He doesn't look like a normal bug. He has two little lights at the front of his head as if he might be part mechanical. The support on the mobile that attaches it to the bed has the word Uniview written into it. It's ornate and it's fancy, and it looks like it's part of the fancy design of the mobile. So the mobile is a Uniview mobile, and it's got this little thing at the top that looks down at the baby. So these people are the privileged class. This is as good as it gets in this version of the future. And the mom looks placid because she's used to this. The baby looks a little bit uneasy, like she's reaching up to the mobile and she's not quite sure of what she's reaching up to. She's supposed to look a little like she's reaching up to her future. And the whole thing is, it's very, very strange. So,
my first view of All for Baby, I sometimes like to kind of walk through a show quickly and get some first impressions. And so my first view of this was it's a very happy painting in many respects. It's a beautiful Barbie doll.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a beautiful Barbie woman, okay?
Yeah.
And the baby is a happy little baby. Beautiful, plump, and,
yep.
And rosy cheeks and, mm-hmm. You know, plump thighs and hands and fists and fingers, and all beautifully rendered, too. Just beautifully rendered. And upon first looking, I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. It could be taken at such a simple level. And then on second look is when I began to realize that there's so much more to this piece. Art is so subjective. I have these fears that our world is becoming that. It is a Uniview. It is a plastic. There's a plastic nature to almost everything in the house, for example. There almost seems to be a plastic sheen to almost everything, as if there's almost a little bit too much plastic in our DNA, that we're becoming plasticized. And it can sound like a bit of a cliche, but it's done so well. It isn't a cliche. It's a truly a statement. I think it's and this concept of the Uniview, it's a probably, I don't know if you intended it for it to be a commentary on the dark side of globalization, but quite honestly, that is one of the things that I would interpret it.
Yeah, I was sort of alluding to the way media is becoming more and more monolithic. You know, we're getting our information from fewer independent sources, and it's also about the power of a gargantuan corporation and how that can infiltrate into every aspect of a person's life. And in this case, it's even controlling the way their body parts grow. So they're completely hooked into the big source out there. This one source probably controls everything that they know about what's going on around them, and it's all seen. It's got its spies everywhere.
There are no trees or living things in the environment outside of the house either. I could find them, but I don't see them there.
No, you're right. Nothing. So you can only imagine what life is like for people living down there in the city below.
Again, this is a painting called All for Baby, and it's difficult for us to talk too much about it without having people see it. Hopefully, do look on the website as we're talking about this.
We continue our in-depth discussion with Jen Trout when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
If you listen to most of the environmental masters, our salvation will come with a clean tech revolution of innovation, invention, and massive investments. And they are right. New technologies are being announced each day that promise to lead us up to the mountain. But one of the most powerful technologies for change comes from the vision that only artists have the tools to create. To Jen Trout and an emerging army of creatives, art is the technology of the future, as you'll come to know when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. We now continue our exploration of the life and longings of one of America's most gifted and dedicated artivists, Jen Trout.
And let's talk about some more. I'm going to run through some of the names here. Mega Mall, one can imagine what that might be about. Madonna of the Salton Sea. Now, people who aren't from California may not be familiar with the Salton Sea, but that's an amazing story. There's also one of my favorites is Invasion. It looks almost like something out of a World War II war poster, rallying people, or it has almost like a Japanese look to it graphically, with the sunburst, mm-hmm. Okay, with a city scene and massive metropolis, but then dominating so powerfully is a bear and a lion and a snake just walking over the city. And, you know, the truth is, I've often wondered, if there isn't a time when the animals may finally just get together and decide it's time to take over. I look at some of the events that are happening on the edges of cities where we find cougars or bears or other animals coming into our world. And there's two reasons for that. One is they don't have food, but another may be that we're actually allowing them to do so, which we haven't in the past. But I also sometimes wonder, when I hear about the stampeding animals, elephants in India, that are just rampaging through towns and you know, snapping up any food they can get, and other situations where, for example, kangaroos are rampaging through areas of Australia, breaking into houses and stealing food. That, you know, this is coming true in some respects. But talk to me about Invasion. It's a powerful piece.
Well, that was actually meant to be a lighter piece compared to the other ones, aimed a little more at kids. I was sort of thinking of the Godzilla movies, you know, the big Godzilla creature and Mothra looming high above Tokyo, and so these animals are descending upon the city, and they're basically screaming at us. They're finally getting our attention by completely invading our space, basically. it's almost like it had to come to that. They had to completely invade Metropolis like a Godzilla creature in order to finally get our attention.
And what's interesting is that these are animals that we can relate to. I think it's interesting that the types of animals, it isn't just Western animals of America. It really is this diversity with a bear. The bear, of course, almost represents America in some respects, but as well a lion, and there's also a cobra. And
there's a lion cub in the foreground, and that was an elk in the background, far off in the distance.
A great diversity of animals. I think it's a really wonderful representation of the diversity of kinds and forms of animals. Yeah, very important. You know, another related piece is Scream. This, again, to me, is such a powerful piece. Is this one designed more for kids? It could be.
That one was also, yes. And Scream is supposed to feel like a scream when you look at it. The colors are very, very bright. Some of them are almost acidic. There are these concentric circles coming out of a point sort of near the middle of the painting, and they go all the way out to the edge of the painting in one part of the painting, and they're sort of psychedelic looking, almost a little hard to look at. And there are these little animals floating around these concentric circles. Down below, there's a futuristic city. Lots of industry and oil wells. There's a huge tiger cub perched on this cityscape, and he's screaming at us at the bottom half of the painting. Next to him is a hot pink coyote pup that has its mouth open, and he looks like he's screaming, and all those concentric circles emanate from his mouth, so the center point of all those circles comes from his mouth. And these two things are huge against this cityscape. They look like they're gigantic.
They are gigantic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Behind that pink coyote is a huge image of a face. It's a nice face. It's a female. The colors are all done in bright blues. She's looking straight at us. We see about half of her face from the front. And all of those concentric circles emanating from the coyote's mouth also line up with where her ear would be. The coyote's sort of in front of part of her face. So what's coming out of his mouth also lines up with her ear, as if she's hearing him scream. And she's just looking at us. She has some pink flowers up at the top of her head, and she looks like she might be some sort of image of nature. So this is about nature hearing the scream of these animals that are suffering, basically. It's really in your face. The animals are screaming at us, and they're screaming at nature, and she's hearing it. And that's pretty much...
Any reason specifically for a pink coyote? The other animals are rendered in natural colors. I'm just curious why a pink... It may have just been an artistic decision, but because your colors are so vivid and bright and powerful. But I did notice the pink coyote.
You know, I was inspired by the psychedelic posters of the 60s when I did this piece. I was looking through a little book on Haight-Ashbury posters, and so I just sort of colored things to look as psychedelic as I wanted, depending on where they were in the piece. His color is pink basically just for the effect to the eye. His coloring is hard to look at. He's so bright.
Right. He's totally unnatural.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It really does stand out. As I say, look at the pictures. They'll make much more sense to you as we talk about this, as you watch and look at them on the website. One of the ones that I found really, you had a whole story interwoven. This becomes one of your ad pieces, and that's Nature and the Mammal. Very interesting, because in this case, you've literally incorporated a bit of a storyline, words, in other words, with this intriguing character. The woman herself represents just sort of a normal mammal woman. She's not particularly beautiful. She's not unbeautiful. She looks like someone who'd live next door, who seems like a pretty nice person, but she's just a regular consumer, sort of, or something. That would be my take on it. What can you tell us about nature and the mammal, and as well the words, which I found intriguing?
It's a large piece, actually. It's about 6 feet tall. And she is, again, supposed to represent another aspect of nature. And the writing on the piece is a haiku that I made up. And it's about how nature doesn't really care whether or not we get our act together, because it will go on to something else once we're done with our run here, if we choose to end it that way. It's a very symmetrical painting. There's like a dark astral background with little stars popping out of the blackness of the background. She's kind of disembodied. Her torso emerges out of an agave plant at the bottom. Behind her head is a huge blossom. It's a rose blossom. And she's got a basket of flowers under one arm, and she has a skull in her left hand, and to her right is, on the opposite side of the painting of the skull, symmetrically to it, is a little polluted-looking image of the earth. And she's got the skull in her hand very casually, sort of looking at us, and she almost has a half smile. She is supposed to be looking at us as if to say, "Hey, it's up to you. Do you want me to recite the haiku? I think I remember." Now, I'm not a writer, but here's my haiku. The mammal was god of the blue and green jewel. All others bowed down. Brilliant creations did its confidence inflate, dazzled by its hand. Overtaking speed, replicating self on self, trampling all else. The mammal was done. Amused nature turned away. The planet was still. And what that means is that the mammal, being the human, was dazzled by its own creations. We're dazzled by our technology, by our power. We're in complete control. The other creatures on this planet bow down to us. We're replicating self on self. We keep reproducing like a virus. Trampling all else, you know, we trample everything around us. The mammal was done. That means we basically used it all up. Amused nature turned away. So the figure of nature turns away and goes on to the next project, basically. And then the last line is, the planet was still. So that's it.
I was intrigued by this concept of the mammal being this dominant creature. And I haven't really thought about that before. There's many powerful animals in the world, but this concept that somehow mammal has been given this privileged but ultimately destructive place, it's intriguing.
Yeah, you know, I think it's hard not to be dazzled by our technology and by what we're able to do.
That's the problem. We live in a world of miracles.
Yeah.
I mean, we do. We live in a world of miracles. We've transcended rational thought, and we're doing things there was a time when people would have said was impossible to do. We now take for granted cell phones and our technologies and capacities to travel off to other planets. You know, it is quite extraordinary. However, somewhere in this process, we just don't seem to take the time to look behind us to see where we've come from, the woods and the waters and the wonder and the mountains. Many of us do, but unfortunately, there's part of this dilemma that you and I and many, many others are fearing right now or feeling right now is the momentum of it. How do we change the? It's basically, we have a problem of momentum. We're just overdoing this thing, and how are we supposed to? It's my own question. Maybe you have an answer. Maybe you've thought about this, but it isn't a momentum issue. well, if we were able to rein this in somehow and kind of deal with it in a more responsible way, that we could live in a paradise, ultimate paradise. Unfortunately, it's just the momentum of this that is the problem.
I'm not an expert, I'm an artist, but it does seem to me that we're almost getting seduced by the idea that this descent into something that we can't pull out of is inevitable. And I can only speak from my own experience here. It's not over till it's over. You can descend pretty far into a pit and still climb out. That's all I have to say about it.
One of the great things about art is the fact that stories are told in an instant, or perhaps in a very short period of time. One of my ancient best friends was a writer, and I was an artist, and we had an incongruity in our art forms. In order for me to appreciate his work, when he'd finish a book or a novel, I had to invest days of my time, days of my time, to be able to give him an impression of what I thought of his work, because you really can't comment until it's over.
Right.
Okay. And he could come in and he could take a look at my work and in an instant make commentary. That is the power of art.
Right. I think it's a tool for the environmental movement that is completely untapped. I think there's a lot of potential there. When you think about the way paintings were used by the Catholic Church to educate the masses of people who couldn't read, it was phenomenally successful. You know, a painting can say so much in about 3 minutes, and a person will, you know, casually look at a painting, turn away from it, think that they've forgotten about it, and find later that it has somehow either affected their subconscious or it consciously bothers them, and they find that they have to come back to the thought of it and resolve something that is just eating at them. But you know, when you're dealing with trying to communicate to a population that is incredibly busy, incredibly distracted, and incredibly overwhelmed a lot of times, you really want to use tools that are as effective as possible in the shortest amount of time. I see great potential for this. There are a lot of artists out there coming out of these ateliers that have sprung up in the last 10 years who can really, really paint and really draw. They're absolutely phenomenal. And there are also a lot of illustrators out there who have been working for the corporations all these years, and they have their own ideas too. This is an untapped resource. And if someone were to sponsor art competitions, I think they would get a tremendous response from artists, because every artist that I know of and that I talk to is very, very disturbed about what's going on. Most of them are, they haven't been cracked upside the head like me. So they're not doing these images full-time like I am. They have to earn a living. They have kids they have to feed. And the way things stand right now, no one is earning a living, you know, doing this kind of imagery. But there have been some environmental art shows in L.A. in the last couple of years. There have been several, and the response to these shows was really phenomenal. A lot of artists did a couple pieces and sent them in, and I was very amazed at the quality of work. And they were very, very popular shows, very, very well attended by the public. And I was also really impressed at the range of imagery. It was really interesting stuff.
Jen Truitt, we're talking to, artist in San Diego. And I agree with you. You're absolutely right. But I will say this. I do believe that your work stands at this point alone. I really haven't seen someone who's been able to say this in a way that is alluring and luxurious and provocative and startling and frightening and hopeful all at the same time. You're truly an artist who is working in realms that very few others are able to achieve. Some people are a little too much in your face, too much shock value. There's many people doing many things. I just wish to say that you really are transcendentally pushing this message in a way that deserves some attention. And I'll also say, because I think this is also important, you know, if you're going to do good art, it takes time. You just plain have to invest real time. How much time do you spend? And I realize it varies, but generally speaking, can you estimate how much time it takes to finish it? One of your pieces?
Well, I'm getting quicker now, but several months of full-time work on most pieces. Four months is not unusual. 4 months of full-time work.
And I mention that because I'd like each person listening to think about themselves, about their work, about how much they're paid, you know, how much they make in their careers, and realize that art of this caliber does take real time. It is a profession, and it's time that people out there reward the artists, because it's important. These messages have power, and they're just as important a part of making a difference on this planet as anything else. So when an artist asks for a reasonable amount of money, meaning thousands of dollars for a piece of work, understand what that really means. Because while you're painting, you're not out making a living doing something else. This is your work. This is your life. This is what you do, and you do it extremely well.
Thanks.
Yeah. I guess maybe one other question. How do you go about finding these visions? How do you do? They're very complex.
It varies a lot from piece to piece. Sometimes I'll be doing something totally unrelated to art, and I'll just get a flash of a basic concept, and I'll write it down, no matter what I'm doing, and come back to it later, and then develop it further, like with, you know, layer upon layer of clarification. And sometimes I'll find an image that intrigues me. For instance, I did a painting called Elephant that features a huge side view of an elephant skeleton with a little normal baby elephant hovering around its knees. I did that piece because I came across a picture of an elephant skeleton in a book, and I was really struck by how human the head looked and how strange the whole skeleton was. And I worked from there, so that piece was as much about the fascination I had with the elephant skeleton head as it was about the environmental idea behind it. A lot of times I find that I'm not given the next step until I'm right at the point where I'm ready to take that step. So I could be working on a piece for several months and not really know how I'm going to get from point A to point B. I just have to trust that when the time comes, I'm going to be given the right information. So what I have to focus on is basically what I do know how to do. And it's always amazing to me how, you know, when I have that trust and I just focus on what I do know, the answer comes. And it's often an unexpected answer. It's often an answer that isn't logical, you know, that doesn't come from the rational mind. I often find that it's almost like a joint effort. I have to sort of reach out and have enough faith in the creative process to get to a certain point. And if I'm willing to do that, the muse or whatever it is comes in to get me to the next step. So I sort of have to surrender a lot of control And I have to be willing to feel like I'm being led sometimes. Although, I do work with pretty tight designs to begin with.
Obviously, you're going to continue to paint into the future, and that almost scares me. In the sense that you're going to keep, I know that you're on a quest here. You're going to keep telling this story, and I'm just concerned because I talk about the fact that, you know, people are talking about the complete death of the amphibian world within 10 years. What are we supposed to do with that knowledge? People who grew up with frogs and salamanders and things. I do my work, you do yours, so many people out there. I encourage everybody out there to keep on doing everything we can right now. Quite honestly, and your work reflects this, it's time to do something now. We have to come to the realization that we're at a crossroads.
Right. In some of the pieces I have lined up, I want to start trying to address the underlying causes of these problems. I have several ideas already. Again, I think it's the sort of situation where I'm going to have to do a certain number of paintings, and then I'll be given the ideas for the next batch, because I don't think I'm supposed to be using a confrontational approach for all of these paintings. You know, there are all kinds of aspects to what's happening, and exploring the root cause of it all is definitely a part of it. I mean, I'd like to do some pieces that show what it feels like to somehow be part of the answer. Those images are not clear to me yet, although I'm beginning to get some indications of where they'll go. So I'm working on that.
And I just have to say, that to me is a fascinating statement, because I think that's precisely where humanity is right now. We don't know what the answer is right now. We just, no one has been able to determine what that is. And you as an artist who seek for that answer and some means to interpret that are searching too, because perhaps as well, that we all need the muse right now. We as a people, as a species, are looking for the muse. We're creating our future here, and we're looking for that way out. We're looking for that creation that will resolve this thing we call the art of living. And I don't have that answer either.
Yeah, you know, it might very well be that it won't be given to us until we make enough of an effort on our own. We just have to have faith that, you know, if we do as much as we possibly can now, when we get to that bridge, we're going to be given the ability to cross it. I mean, I know it looks terrible. I was just on a website this morning on the sixth mass extinction, and it was listing all the species that are supposed to die off in the next 10, 20, 30, or 50 years. And it was completely overwhelming.
It is completely overwhelming.
Yeah.
When I think about the chimpanzees and gorillas that are so threatened right now, and snow leopards, and animals that have always been legacy creatures for us, they were the great iconographic mystery power objects in our lives as children and adults. And the fact that we're facing a future where they may just not be here anymore, what a disaster for us on our watch.
Yeah.
What a loss to the children of the future, to all of us. And quite honestly, the real question is, will we really be able to survive when we have this level of this miraculous balance of nature being ripped out? I think some of us wonder.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like we're operating at a level of reality that actually isn't real. When I was dealing with the illness, I had financial problems a lot of the time because I couldn't work. And I was very tempted to go back to doing storyboard work. And I had two sets of reality that were sort of like fighting for space in my head. And I used to flip-flop back and forth between them. One reality said, you know, it's crazy to not be doing anything to bring in money. Go back to doing some storyboard work. You're not going to be able to pay your bills. And it was everything that I grew up with. That was the reality that was sort of my upbringing. So the other reality was the one that said, you don't know what the answers are, but this work you're doing is what's keeping you alive. And if you want to stay alive, you're not going to waste any time worrying about money. It's a completely different reality. Plus, the work you're doing is important. I mean, it might be that one person sees one of these paintings, and that person is the one who's going to make the difference. You know, even if that's what all your work is all about, that's important. So, you know, these two realities were just so utterly different that I had quite a battle going on. I think that's what we're dealing with as a society. We have one reality where we think, you know, well, we have traffic to worry about and the mortgage and, you know, the kids work in school and, you know, things that used to be very pressing issues but are really more like distractions now. Then we have the other reality, which is basically that we all need to absolutely drop everything. I mean, and I do mean drop everything and pay attention to what's happening. So, you know, it might very well be that something really drastic happens to snap us out of one reality into the real reality. When you talk about one reality versus another reality, also, I was watching Ken Burns' World War II documentary a couple weeks ago, and I was really struck by the mobilization of the country for the war effort. Everybody was involved. It was the issue of the day, and it affected people's work, it affected what people bought, it affected, you know, their food, what they wore, cosmetics. People relocated to work at these plants that turned out one bomber an hour or something like that. It was an incredible production. And that's what we need to be doing here. And it was because they had a sense that the threat from Hitler's regime and everything that was happening in Europe was so immediate that they needed to change everything in their lives in order to address it properly. I think we're at that point now, and I think that we can address this issue the way our society addressed what was going on in Europe and succeeded. All that's lacking is the will. So, if we could do it then, we can do it now.
Well, this is what I would say, and that is the fact that I'm going to follow your work, and I encourage others to do the same and to, you know, seek out Jen Truth's work now and into the future, because perhaps it can be a catalyst, it can be a means to help us find that muse. Artists typically lead the way. They really do, and this discussion is an indication of perhaps why, because there's so much that is being processed and then turned into form that we can quickly understand that otherwise words cannot express effectively and as efficiently. Jen Truth, JENTRUTE.com. Go there, contact her. I'm sure many of you out there, some of you out there may wish to collect her work, because I do believe it will be significant in the future. This would be a good time to get in. Jen Truth, thanks so much for all that you do.
Well, thank you for the interview.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Sydney.
Some would say that we need a real revolution from our old ways on this earth to a new vision that harmonizes and balances the human and vast communities of wonder. This is a call to action, to pick up your pens and pencils, brushes and voices, to inspire the change that simply must come soon. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios, until we meet again next Thursday or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.